Ivan Emmanuel Owens, Ai Weiwei and David Swerner, Hans Ulrich Obrist and Julia Payton Jones, Nicholas Serota, Larry Gagosian and Glenn D. Lowry, Marina Abramovich, Adam D. Weinberg, Carolyn Christoph Bakardiev. Wolfgang Tillmans, Marion Goodman, Monica Sprit, and Philomena Majors, Jeff Koons, Bernard Blisten, and Serge Lavigne, Adam Simchik, Okwi, and Wizor, and Hitor Steyer, Massimiliano Gioni, and Maya Hoffman.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And this week's programme is part two of the top 100 art movers as presented by Canadian artist Bill Burns. Bill, perhaps you could... This is actually the one we're listening to was the one we played last week. This is part one.
That's right. We had the world premiere of the Power 100 list sung as a Georgian chant. And it's arranged by Alan Gasser and sung by Alan Gasser and Emma Gasser.
Yeah. And when we say top 100, this is basically a found list of the top 100 art movers and shakers as defined by Art Review.
Yeah, Art Review is a magazine in the field. Yes.
Right. So it only occurred to me for the first time. Are they in some order? Was the first one top of the list? Is he or she number one?
Yes, that's right. They're the top of the list. And every year the list has rankings and people have their rankings fall or rise.
So it's reassessed all the time, yeah, sort of like the stock exchange.
It is a little bit like that. In fact, they even have little arrows that go up and down,
really?
Just like the stock exchange.
Okay, yeah. So who was the very... I missed the very first one. Who is that?
I think it's this year's... this is the 2015 most recent list. And Ivan Worth is...
Ivan Worth?
Yeah. Is the top.
I've never heard of this person.
Ivan and Manuela. They're collectors and dealers.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So So the Art Review would select this list of 100, like the top 10 almost, with people going up and down according to reputation. Or what would define them specifically? What would make somebody number one?
Well, I guess...
Well, don't you care? Perhaps you don't care, because you don't have to define it.
It's not really my list, but I suspect it has to do with, often would have to do with a kind of marketplace, their position in the marketplace,
uh-huh.
how much art they're moving through their gallery and things like that. But on the other hand, there's other kinds of capital that involved in art. And so for some people, it's less about the money and more about different kind of power relations. So our review calls it the Power 100.
Okay.
And I don't...
So it's about influence and clout
within
the art world.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of... I mean, there's somebody there like Wolfgang Tillmans who I'm very surprised. I had no idea he would even rank up there, but he's almost like up there with number 10.
Yeah, so some of the rankings, they kind of give little explanations of their rankings.
Yeah.
It's made by the editorial board of the magazine.
Yeah.
And the explanations are someone like Wolfgang would have a lot of influence on a younger generation of artists, for instance. And so that would give him a kind of ranking.
Do you think they do surveys to establish this? I mean,
no, I think it's all just very arbitrary.
So the art review, I mean, how do you rate the art review? Is it something you read?
Well, I do pick it up in the library. I don't subscribe. So, you know, it's a good enough magazine, but it's not something that I pick up in the magazine shop.
But is it an influential magazine?
It is an influential magazine, but yeah, very one of the...
American?
Yeah, it's American. Okay. And I think they have a London office. So,
right. So this the one we're listening to was played in its entirety last week, and this week you have a different version of it. We're going to play part two later.
Yes, thanks for reminding me. We're going to premiere the new version, which is arranged by artist Andrew Zuckerman, my collaborator on the project, and it's sung by the wondrous voices of Zoe, Alexis, Abrams, and John Cresson.
So how does it differ? Why have you got two versions?
The second version, I was thinking of kind of just trying to find different ways of making it, of bringing it into kind of a beautiful place. And these are people who are on the Power 100 list, like Hans Ulrich Obrist, David Zwirner, Marina Abramović.
Yeah.
So we need to have a kind of a special voicing and the like. So the new one has an operatic quality, but also kind of some hollering kind of style and also kind of was thinking a little bit around those projects like Towers Open Fire by William Burroughs and Anthony Belch.
Yeah.
Which have a lot of that kind of the sense of like frustration, but also exploding, emotional explosion. So that's where the opera singer, I thought, was would come in.
So there's no Georgian chant in this one, then?
There's no Georgian chant. It's not...
Happen to have Towers Open Fire with me.
Oh, wow.
Do you want to hear... I mean, should we play a bit of that?
Yeah,
Yeah. Okay. So you are... you're obviously a Burroughs fan. In fact, we went to see a Burroughs film, didn't we, at the NFT, at the National Film Theatre.
Yeah, that was...
Has Burroughs been a particular influence on you with regard to this piece?
Well, yeah, with regard to this work, I think last week we talked a little bit about the way that I thought that the current kind of condition of art and the art world, I felt like it might not leave space for William Burroughs today or for, you know, a Robert Filliou type.
Yeah. Robert Filliou being sort of the Fluxus artist. Didn't he open a shop in Nice with the two of them? Can't remember the other guy now. The two of them opened a shop in Nice, which was
Brotters,
a bit of a kind of a hoax shop. I don't think actually...
And then the Musée Légitime was something that he had, a museum that traveled around, an itinerant museum that he had in his hat.
Right.
And then he had a few... artifacts in his hat, and he would show people and invite them to visit his museum, which was in his hat.
Okay. Well, here's some Burroughs. I'm going to be Sounds almost like it's going backwards to me. I don't know if that's... I don't remember it. It doesn't matter. It's fine. Yeah. We get the picture. So it's a collage piece, is it? Cut-up tapes? Or?
Yeah, the Towers Open Fire is kind of a cut-up, yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess what I found interesting about that is kind of the freedom that's involved in that kind of process of the cut up, and also, you know, how much influence it has had, but that also the people involved in the process are very, there's a lot of sincerity in this, in his projects, and not just William Burroughs, but Brian Geisen and Anthony and the people involved in the larger projects.
So you're here in London. You've been teaching in the Yukon.
That's right.
And you're on your way to Barcelona. You're here for 1 week.
Mm-hmm.
And how much brown nosing have you managed to get in this week?
Well, I try and do some brown nosing on on every occasion.
Yeah.
And
because your project, I think last week we described it as brown nosing as art. In a way, it's the elevating of your own reputation to that of the 100 big movers.
This could be the last time I'm on your show.
Well, I thought you were in approval of this. No,
I think so.
I thought this was your description. I've never heard of brown nosing before. It's only you New World people that bring it over to me.
Well, I think brown nosing may be something that is more common in the New World.
Here we call it sycophancy, according to Sarah.
Yeah.
But it's about, no, because you last week we played three examples of you paging yourself, having yourself paged at train stations, associating with bigwigs.
Bigwigs, that's right. I
mean, what is that if it's not association by you're trying to attach your name to the, I mean, I know it's a sort of joke.
Yeah, it's a kind of a like what I found in the production of art is that the marketplace is ruled by a kind of hagiography, or I don't know if it's ruled, but the kind of hagiographic component of the marketplace, not just in terms of the monetary function of art, but also the cultural components. So in order to try and place myself into that structure, I've had myself paged in international airports and train stations. And
but is this because you feel that you belong in that list yourself?
Well, I guess that's we'd have to ask my therapist about that.
And do you have a therapist?
I'm not sure if we're.
I thought I was your therapist.
We can go there, but I think that I think there is a, you know, there's a kind of a
I mean, a twisted, I don't think. I mean, I think most people. I personally think that most people would sort of read it in that way. I think that's an obvious kind of reaction.
Yeah.
To what is happening there? I mean, it's not. I don't think I'm sort of. I'm not saying that in a vindictive way. It just seems to be natural you go to a public space, you have your name broadcast alongside Beatrix Roof or Nicholas Sirota, whoever it is, which is, and it's kind of there is. It's like a joke. It's sort of funny. It's to people that would know about it, but it's a very in joke, isn't it?
It is a very in joke, and I think you're right that I think it's John Baldessari who says that the most obvious thing about a work of art is usually the most important, and. And I think that is the obvious thing about this is that I would like to be there. Yeah. But it's also, I know the consequences of being there too, like to be in this kind of...
So you're being ironic. You're almost stepping back from. You're sort of. It's almost like you've created an alter ego. It reminds me a little bit of that film with Jerry Lewis, where there's the Rupert Pupkin guy who wants to be Jerry Lewis, you know, and he kidnaps somebody in order to be, to get his chance on in the big time.
Yeah, I like that illusion.
But it's almost as though you have created this scenario, which you've stepped back from. It's almost like. Your persona as an artist, and then you tell this story where that artist would become famous or elevated. And so there's a sort of human, you've become detached from yourself in a way.
The story is, you know, it is autobiographical in the sense that it's a story of my story, which is the story of trying to, you know, find a place in this. Structure of, you know, this place in the world.
Yeah.
You know, mostly it's like how to make a living, you know, like that's kind of where it comes from, you know.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's not a lot of middle ground in the art world. There's like unknowns and there's...
Here we go. Yeah. There's knowns and unknowns and the knows and the, however it goes.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. And, so what we're saying is it's like a pyramid structure. There's maybe, well, there's one at the top and then it goes down until you get to like a million artists who will never ever get to the top of that pyramid.
Yeah, that's likely.
And so, and so it's and, a question of are you happy in your with your position in that pyramid? Can you just is the work enough for you, or do you hanker after the to, you know, you want to be bigger?
Yeah, well, I guess I'm kind of in a kind of limbo. I put myself into a kind of limbo situation where I'm playing it both ways, you know.
Right.
I'm saying, you know, I'm pretty happy where I am, and I also know that to be in the, you know, to play in the big leagues, is a big, it's a whole different construction of having a business. Like I had a meeting with. Colin DeLand. I had an exhibition at American Fine Arts in New York in the 90s in a project space kind of with Colin. And Colin said to me, do you really want a, you know, do you really want a New York gallery? Like, not like his, because his was smaller. But he said, do you want that kind of Gagosian style thing? Because that is a big... it's a kind of a job where you have to have established a studio, have assistants, have accountants, you know, have a registrar, you know, and it's probably not the kind of business that I want to be in.
Is that because do you think you're temperamentally not suited to it, or you're not?
I just think for me to run just having my own little art practice, making small drawings and.
Yeah.
Audio recordings, you know, is mostly what I want to do. You know?
Sure.
And I wouldn't, I don't mind being a little bit bigger than that,
you have a reputation, you are represented by a gallery somewhere?
Yes, in Toronto. And
but then you've made a project out of this idea of the artist yourself climbing. The I don't know. Can we call it the greasy pole? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Is it you're trying to get bigger and better?
Like mm-hmm.
And you're making a joke out of that at the same time, whilst perhaps achieving it by creating this project. It's a sort of it's like a paradoxical situation, isn't it?
Yes, it is a paradox.
Do you want to read out this letter? There was this. Incident with the bobbleheads. You created some bobbleheads of famous curators.
Yes, I made some bobbleheads of a number of well-known curators that are also on the Power 100 list, and they're directors of museums in New York, London, Amsterdam, Vienna, Rome, and so. And then I made a brochure and I've sent it out to a number of people and it has pictures of of my bobbleheads. So it's promotion for the bobbleheads.
But one of these curators took exception.
That's right. One of them took exception. And so I've had to put out recently, because I sent out the brochure, I felt that in order to do due diligence with this legal threat from one of the curators, that I needed to send out a letter to all the people who I sent out a brochure to. So this letter I'm sending, in fact, this afternoon I'm going to send it out to Ivana Blaswick at the Whitechapel Gallery.
You're going to send it?
Yes, it's not sent yet.
Okay.
So I'm going to read it before I send it.
Right.
And I hope Ivana is not listening, but it's not.
She might be.
Yes, you never know. But if she is, she'll get the information before the letter arrives.
Okay.
So this is from addressed from me to Ivana Blaswick. Dear Ivana, I regret to inform you that there is a problem with the brochure I sent you in the past few months. The brochure is called Amazing Curators, Collectors, and Museums of the World. Please see pictures below. The problem relates to one of the curators depicted in the brochure. He is very upset and has threatened legal action. The problematic image can be seen below. I would ask that you cut and paste the black band provided over the eyes of the image in question to protect the curator's identity. A dab of glue will be required. I hope this will solve the problem and that my legal issues will abate. Below is an example of the simple fix and how it should look. As you can see, it is an easy task and will take only a few minutes of your time. It's a shame to cover it up, but unfortunately, it's a request that needs to be fulfilled. Thank you in advance for your attention. Warm regards. And I have a picture of the before and after with the band across the the bobblehead, the picture of the bobblehead.
Bobblehead doll being one of these, it's a little plastic figurine that where the head sort of wobbles around on top
that's
of it.
Right. There's a little spring.
A bit like a nodding dog thing that you used to get in the back of cars.
That's right, yes. And so I'm sending that out to Ivana and quite a few other people who I've sent the brochure to before I knew about this troubles.
Yes. Okay. When did you send her the brochure?
I sent the brochure. The brochure probably went out in the winter time when I was up in the Yukon. That's why I have a couple of pictures of the brochure just as an ed memoir for the people that may not recall.
Again, the whole thing it sounds terribly tongue-in-cheek. There's something quite insincere about it in a strange way, which is strange because you cite William Burroughs as though he's an artist or a guy who would not make it in today's climate because of his apparent sincerity. But it's this structure of this sort of individual that the thing you're detaching yourself from is like a hoaxer in a way. Because this is so, you're sending something to, you sent something to Blaswick last winter, and now you're asking her to censor it herself. Because you're, but it is a joke in a way.
Well, I'm trying to cover my myself legally here.
Right.
However, I am relying on the goodwill of the arts professionals.
Yeah. You also have a book out, don't you? You've got a book out called Hans Ulrich Obrist Heroes, published by Black Dog Press. And the book is, when did this come out? Last year?
It just came out. Actually, the publication date is January 2016.
Yeah.
Although I had some copies of it in the fall.
And this is available from the London Review Bookshop. And right. Also Marcus Campbell Art
Marcus
Books
Campbell
near
Art
to
Books, and
Tate Modern.
I heard that it's at the Serpentine Bookstore as well.
Okay. So, do you want to read a passage from?
I could read a short passage. The book is a memoir about my about how I became an artist and then how I've tried to position myself in the art world to become more successful. And I met this in this passage that I'm about to read. I've met this curator in Paris at a cafe, and he's curating the Taipei Biennial, and so it's a quite a good opportunity for me. This happened about I think it's like 13 or 14 years ago, so we had this meeting that was non-committal. But I had quite a bit of hope. And at the end of the meeting, he asked me, he said that he was coming to Toronto late that summer, and would I arrange a wilderness adventure for him? And so I was happy to oblige. He wanted to see Northern Lights and moose. That was on his agenda. So the thought that he would arrive on the transatlantic flight with his dog had not crossed my mind. He was, at first, beyond convincing of the impracticality, but my knowledge of both common law and the law of the wild held sway. The dog was kenneled, but we are now a full day behind schedule. I've decided to take him myself out on this adventure. We skipped the next day's breakfast, opting for a bagel and lox in the canoe. We had a lot of paddling ahead of us. Truth be told, I did not expect him to be much of a paddler, but I was mistaken. It turned out he had been practicing in hotel rooms with the help of a video and a specially designed chair with the tiny retractable legs. Our destination was a gorgeous sight on a windswept corner of Lake Manitou in Algonquin Park. I conducted the canoe straight for the point. Nightfall surprised us. The stars glowed like sparks of lightning, sparks of light shining through the theater curtain that had been eaten by moths. We dragged the canoe up the bank, set up the tent under the stars, and dozed off. When morning arrived, perhaps owing to the fact that he was still adjusting to the new time zone, the young curator was anxious to defecate. But he was undone by his lack of woodsmanship. From the little information I was able to gather, his squat was well positioned. He found a gentle slope. His aim was good, and the sun sparkled through the birches. However, it was in extracting himself from the situation that something went awry. Whatever it was made his testicles swell. They became now the size of navel oranges, now the size of grapefruits, now the size of melons. As luck would have it, I had accumulated a certain amount of wisdom about the natural care of people in such circumstances. Firstly, I used my own T-shirt and some particularly green willow branches to jerry-rig a sling to hold the curator's delicate cargo. Secondly, I concocted a poultice composed of ribbed bog moss, pine needles, and whey bread to soothe the pain and extract the contents of the grub-colored pustules that had erupted all over the afflicted area. I gently applied and removed the poultice every few hours. I made him infusions of spearmint and gooseberry leaves. When he needed to relieve himself, I helped him on and off with the sling. When the northern lights appeared, I dragged him out of the tent by his armpits until his head passed the tent's awning. Within a few days, the swelling had subsided. He and his dog returned to Taiwan. I was sure my vigilance would garner me a special place at the Biennale. But it seemed I had crossed the threshold of intimacy. My work was not selected.
Right. Is this fiction?
No, these are real stories from my...
This might be the last time you come on my show, actually. Telling a story like that, you should be ashamed of yourself.
Well, it's a kind of a... I hope there's some listeners there that can learn something from those stories that...
This is a true story. Mm-hmm. Have you seen him since?
No, I haven't.
Is he named?
No, he's not. Okay. There's a section in the earlier that explains why he's not named.
All right. Okay. But, so this is from your book, Hans Ulrich Obrist Heroes.
That's right. And the Hans Ulrich Obrist Heroes, the title comes from the kind of laments and litanies that are common in prayers from Christian, Judaic, and Quranic prayers as well.
Right.
So,
okay. I'm just going to play you a track which you weren't... I didn't tell you I was going to play this, but we could just listen to this. Very brief.
Okay, great.
You recognize that?
I don't. Is that...
No. Yeah. It's from Central West Greenland. And it's it says the present song is the oldest sound recording of traditional singing in Greenland. Wow. Despite much noise, the simple tune is still audible. And it sounds like it was recorded in about 1905. Due to the early arrival of the mission in western central Greenland, these regions were the first to discontinue traditional Inuit singing and replaced it with European hymns and songs.
Wow. Oh, fantastic.
Is that your sort of... Is the Yukon where you teach, is that anywhere in that kind of neck of the woods?
Well, it's there is a lot of connections right across the Arctic. So there are a lot of people that travel between the Yukon and Greenland and Norway and the like.
Right. So
those are some of the connections. So, and there are some First Nations and Inuit connections that go right across the north. So people in Greenland will meet with Northerners in Canada about political or environmental issues, but also about cultural things, and throat singing is a tradition right across the north.
So you teach 3 months of the year in the Yukon in a school which apparently is owned by Inuit people.
It's operated by the First Nations. The First Nation is called the Gwich'in Nation, the Trondegwich'in First Nation,
right.
And they are. They're an excellent employer.
And you've been doing this regularly for about 6 years or something?
Yeah, they've invited me as an artist, they call it a visiting artist position. So I get to have a fairly loose schedule that allows me to make a work. And so I've gone up there now. This coming year will be my fifth year there, so it's...
So you're teaching contemporary art or just art?
Yeah, it's a contemporary art program. Most of our students actually come from away and are coming for an adventure in the Arctic.
Uh-huh.
So it's a pretty special place. And I've gotten to know some of the people in the First Nation community, and they're kind of... stories about their culture, how they, how they connect to the land and to the food. They're very, food is really central. Food from the land is very central to their life. And the caribou are around there. There's bison, there's caribou, there's moose, and when you arrive in one of the small towns up there, they almost always you're greeted by with a piece of meat, quite sometimes quite large.
Yeah.
In fact, so it's giving me
raw meat.
Sometimes they cook. It's cooked, but when I arrived in Old Crow recently with a group of my students, they gave us a large piece of raw meat. So
right.
There was quite a bit of cooking to do.
Yeah.
And that was caribou. So
okay. And do you think do the people in this school do you teach them the ways of the art world?
Do
they need to be instructed in the or would you teach them just to plow their own furrow and ignore the market?
Well, I kind of I would say I try and teach the idea that I've been at it a long time and I still don't understand it, and so I don't really think there's there's some things that I might be able to impart to them.
Mm.
But mostly, I like the idea that they might do the plow their own furrow, so
yeah.
to speak, because I've been at this a long time and I'm not really sure if I got it right or not. The jury's
right.
still out.
Okay. Interesting.
But I find the students. I think nowadays there's it's really interesting that the large. The idea of that large marketplace, the New York, London, Hong Kong, São Paulo kind of art market, doesn't resonate so much with students.
Right. You were at Goldsmiths, weren't you?
Yes.
Way back. Mm-hmm. Was it the year before Damien Hirst and his team?
No, Damien would have been there at the same time as me, but he was in the undergraduate program. When I was, most of the stars came out of the undergraduate program,
right.
I went to the graduate program.
Right.
But
what would you have done differently if you could go back now to that time? Do you think were there any career moves you might have made that would have? Is there anything you do different?
Not really. I actually enjoy almost everything I do. And it's I've been successful enough that I can travel, I can do projects. I've done projects almost all over the world.
Hmm.
And they're usually, they're not like huge. I'm not the star of a big festival or something, but yeah. I can usually pull something off to get me somewhere for a few months to make a project.
Yeah.
And so that's been fun. I guess I would... There's a few friends that I would have liked to have kept in touch with.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that would be one of my regrets. But mostly it's just because things got too busy or I moved or
Well, maybe we should play your other the operatic piece.
Yeah.
Can I introduce my
collaborators?
Indeed.
Yeah.
And the title and this piece is 12 minutes long, I think.
Yeah. It should come about 12 and a half minutes, I think. And it's a collaboration with Andrew Zuckerman, who's done the arrangement. And the voices are Zoe Alexis Abrams and John Gresson. The other artists are also from Toronto. So I'll try and find the document.
Mm-hmm. So this is part two or version two of the Power 100.
That's right, and this is the more operatic style. And I was kind of riffing on Burroughs a little bit, or thinking about that, and that's what Andrew and I talked about. So Andrew did most of the heavy lifting here, and I'm. Again, my libretto is a found libretto, mm-hmm. And it's based on the Art Review Power 100 list.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. Today's guest is Bill Burns, and that was his concept. Can you give me the title again, Bill?
It's the Power 100 sung in opera and Georgian chant.
Well, the one last week was Georgian chant. This one sounds almost like Japanese kabuki theater or something.
Zoe Alexis Abrams, the opera singer there, she tends to sing operatic work, and John Cresson is a baritone. So the work is obviously, it's a kind of a stretch to call it opera, but there is this operatic style.
Yeah. It's the same 100 names.
It is the same 100
but you
names.
You can hardly, I mean, personally, I could only decipher a few of them.
Yeah, these are a bit, more stretched out.
Indeed.
Opera tends to be a little, I guess that's why they have subtitles at opera.
Oh, yeah.
At the opera.
Right.
But we have the, you know, the same people, David Zwirner, Hans Ulrich Obrist, Julia Payton-Jones, Liam Gillick, Charles Esche,
It's pretty mad, isn't it, really? It's kind of like an artist's nightmare or something.
Yeah, I wanted to work with that style just to see where it might go. And also, I think, it is that kind of, it's kind of a dark opera in some ways.
So something that an ambitious artist might sort of wake up in the middle of the night, sort of with this thing going through their head. You know,
I never thought of that. But
thinking, you know, good, yeah. Where is my name in this? You know. So you took the concept. It was your concept, and you kind of basically took it to someone else to make a musical composition out of.
That's right. Yeah. Right. And I should mention Andrew Zuckerman is my collaborator on the project, and he's made the arrangement for this project.
Yeah.
So thank you, Andrew.
Okay. And will it be? You were saying that if people want to get the full list of these 100 people.
Oh yes.
They could email me.
They could email. You can email.
But can't they find it's the art review list, isn't it? Presumably, you can go to the art review list.
It's not really rocket science to find it.
No.
If you put Power 100 art from the art review, you'll find it easily.
Okay.
And this is the 2015 list, which is the most current list. The list is published, I think, every October.
Right.
And not to be missed.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Bill Burns. You're now on your way to Barcelona.
What does
the future hold?
Well, a small project in Barcelona where might involve a bit of goats and goat milk and some reading from my book. And then also in Toronto, I'm doing some goat milkings and some honey rendering coming up in the fall.
Goat milking.
Yes, I like to invite goats into the city and then milk them and take some milk from them.
Right.
And then mix it with honey.
Right. And where is this performance art or is the product the milk and honey, does that become the art object or all of those things?
I never thought of it. The milk and honey if you're interested I could do yogurt with it or any kind of
okay. When do
quark.
You get back to your therapist? This therapist we mentioned earlier. When is this? Actually, you're going to do this. But you're going to do this in cities regularly.
Yes, it's I find that we're not very in touch with animals in cities, and so but I've I I I go to Latin America a fair amount, and I've noticed that animals are really part of cities in Latin America. Uh-huh. So, and I'm trying to introduce them, reintroduce them into our cities. Bringing them into galleries or kind of performance events is one way for people to be in touch. And goats are really a very gentle animals to bring in, and they seem to enjoy socializing. It sort of works both ways.
Yeah. And the milking, you do the milking?
I don't really do much.
Oh.
I do hold the bucket, usually.
Okay. But is there some connotation between the land of milk and honey here? Is this something going
on? Well, I think
so.
I think, again, the most obvious thing about a work of art is usually the most important.
Right, so, as we said earlier. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we could go out on your one of your choir pieces. This is the children's choir of dogs on boats and airplanes. So thank you very much, Bill, for coming in today. And we do not seem to have anything on. Yes. It starts quietly.
Try not to hold your breath, but just breathe naturally, quietly, okay? So this is going to be a long session, so just keep on moving with it. So we're ready to go. Remember, we're going to have the 10 seconds of silence at the end as well. So. Okay, one. Hands down. Two. And three.